So at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, I headed up to Capitol Hill for a cocktail. Oh, by the way, you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Kevin Kniestad, in for Gabriel Spitzer this week. And I ended up at Liberty Bar, and the cocktail I was after is called Point of No Return, which also happens to be the theme of the show this week, Point of No Return. And we're going to hear stories, those moments, those points where you're faced with the decision to never go back. But before that, we're going to have Keith Waldbauer, who created this very interesting craft cocktail, make us the Liberty's take on the Point of No Return. All right, Keith, so it's noon somewhere. Go for it.
Absolutely. So we're going to start by curling a little bit of rosemary into the bottom of a rocks glass. And we're going to measure in about a half ounce of green chartreuse.
So you have like a full sprig of rosemary in the bottom of this glass mixed with chartreuse.
Kind of like Caesar's crown right at the bottom. So first we're going to measure in an ounce and a half of gin. And we'll pour that right into our mixing glass. And we're going to measure in 3/4 of an ounce of lime juice, along with 3/4 of an ounce of simple syrup. We have set aside about 1/4 of an ounce of absinthe, and we're going to light this on fire. So now the chartreuse is on fire, and it's effectively cooking the rosemary. So we have a big fire going on here, and we're going to douse that with the actual cocktail itself. So I'm going to pour the whole thing, ice and all. And voila, there we have it. The Point of No Return.
All right, can I give it a taste here?
Absolutely, that's what it's there for.
Wow, that's really, really good. So how did you come up with the idea to light rosemary on fire and incorporate that into a drink?
Well, to be perfectly honest, the idea itself comes from a friend of mine, Jamie Boudreau. He named that cocktail the Rubicon. I did a variation on it in the grand tradition of bartenders stealing from other bartenders, and found out that the Rubicon was a river in Rome. Julius Caesar crossed that river in an iconic gesture. Crossing the Rubicon entered into the lexicon and kind of loosely translates as point of no return.
Have you ever felt like any patrons, anybody who's ever had a couple points of no return drinks, have reached that point of no return at the end of the night?
Well, on the record, I will say that everyone that I've served this drink to has returned.
Thanks to Liberty Bar, and thank you, Keith Waldbauer, for helping us kick off our Point of No Return show. In just a minute, friends will help recap the news of the week, so don't go away. I'm going to try just one more sip of this. That's really, really good. Thanks, Keith.
Thank you.
Well, before we start exploring stories of the Point of No Return this week, we are joined by some of our favorite journalists, who I'm happy to say did not reach the Point of No Return with our show here, and are back to recap the news of the week with us. Joining us this week is Hannah Brooks Olson from Seattle-ish. Mike Lewis is acting online managing editor here at KPLU, and Sarah Studeville is co-founder of the Seattle Globalist. Welcome to Sound Effect.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, of course, big news came down yesterday when the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to legalize same-sex marriage nationwide. Washington State, of course, was one of 34 states where same-sex marriage was already legal, but this does have some impact on couples from Washington, and perhaps the biggest being when they travel to states that previously had a ban on same-sex marriage. Same-sex couples that travel or move to states that had bans on same-sex marriage will now have their marriages legally recognized in those states, and they'll be afforded the same rights as heterosexual couples, such as visitation rights, should a spouse end up in the hospital. So what kind of reaction do we have to that news that came down yesterday morning?
I was listening to President Obama speak yesterday morning. He made a statement pretty close after the fact that was like an incredibly emotional statement. And one of the things he mentioned was that, you know, it was a decision by the Supreme Court, but it was also something that was sort of a long time coming, and he mentioned small acts of courage, at which point I just like lost it in my bathroom. I was like putting on my makeup and I had to pause because it was so sort of emotional, and because I think that calling that out, those small acts of courage, is really incredible because, you know, for me, I started my activism career as a literal child in the state of Oregon trying to keep a ban on same-sex marriage out of our state constitution. I think I was like 9 years old at the time collecting signatures, and so I love that it's a decision by the Supreme Court that is huge, but it's also the culmination of just years of activism.
Yeah, I really agree with that. I was thinking about Obama's speech myself, and actually the words that really got me were justice like a thunderbolt, right? Oh. And that came right as I was sitting in my kitchen, and the house across the street on the second floor, the window opens and a huge rainbow flag unfurls. Mm. And I was just like, yes, you know, I mean, it was just such an amazing moment for the nation. But I also think it was an amazing moment to be in this city, from this city. So many of those small acts of courage and so much of that work has come out of Seattle.
I felt a little bit of jealousy when Ireland jumped out there first. And I was particularly pleased when this one came down because it was a moment, and you look all through Facebook, and a friend of mine who's a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, and people just have this, regardless of your opinion on it, I mean, it's a basic civil right, and now it's codified as such. And I think that that's a reason to be, you know, genuinely proud to be an American.
Well, this will no doubt be an additional reason to celebrate with a Pride Parade getting underway here in Seattle in a little bit less than an hour. Another story that we've been following this week is Mayor Murray's signing of an executive order on Tuesday to create a new cabinet office, the Office of Planning and Community Development. And the mayor cites this as a way to manage the city's ongoing population and construction boom and address issues like traffic, crowding in schools, and access to open space. So, Mike Lewis, let's start with you. Is this a Band-Aid for damage already done, or do you see this new cabinet office being able to get ahead of future issues?
Well, it's a little late in coming. Potential. I mean, I guess we'll all find out whether or not it has a capacity to be something more than a MASH unit for the existing problems in Seattle regarding development. I mean, I've talked to a couple of friends who deal with big developers, and mind you, they don't like to say a lot of things publicly because no one wants their project put on ice. But they would say that while Seattle is good at assessing individual projects, it doesn't assess the cumulative effect of 15 projects in a neighborhood. And I think that sort of thing, one would hope, is what this office is going to actually be able to address.
Hannah Brooks Olson, could this also be seen as simply a PR move for the mayor to gain favor with voters?
Anytime Ed Murray sort of makes one of these big, grandiose announcements, all I see is that his reelection is creeping up on him. Ed Murray is not a subtle man. He is a man who makes big gestures, and this is a big gesture. It reminds me a lot of a couple of months ago, he kind of came out of nowhere with this announcement that he was going to build, or like under his watch, we were going to build 50,000 new units in 10 years, 20,000 of which were going to be affordable. And that number doesn't really jive with other predictions. Crosscut reported this week that it's looking closer to, we're going to add like 70,000 units in 20 years. And so I feel like a lot of times the mayor sort of acts independently. And what concerns me with this decision is that I think it's absolutely true that we do need to have a more holistic approach on how we do development. Walking around Capitol Hill, you can see that it's just sidewalk after sidewalk after sidewalk is closed because no one has looked at sort of what the impact of four construction projects that are huge on one block, exactly. Right? But there are aspects of DPD, so the Department of Planning is sort of being dismantled to make this new cabinet. And there are aspects of that haven't really been ironed out yet. Like, who is actually going to be doing land use? It was another announcement from Ed that came without a whole lot of additional planning and maybe could have been done, you know, more with the assistance of city council or more, you know, not sort of in this big, like, line item way that he tends to do things.
Maybe he needs an office of planning.
You know, he might need like a Seattle process office.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sarah Studeville, were there a whole lot of specific plans to take away from Mayor Murray's announcement?
You know, honestly, my first reaction to the news was, well, I guess I'm glad someone in city government is being paid to worry about this. Like, you know, that was kind of, as far as I got, I'm like, that feels a little bit better than it seeming like they just really aren't responding at all, because obviously all of us are feeling the impacts of this development on our lives every single day. But no, I agree that it just felt like it didn't come with the actionable items that would have made me believe that it's really going to have an impact. Also, I just felt like there should have been more of an emphasis on how this development is impacting low-income communities specifically. There should have been a little more, a couple of lines towards that. They really are the communities that are most impacted. They have the least opportunity to voice their concerns about how they're impacted. I don't know. I mean, I want to hope that this will make things better, but I'm kind of with Hannah on this one. We'll see.
All right. Well, those are our top stories for the week. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Kevin Kniestedt in for Gabriel Spitzer this week. And we're joined by Sarah Studeville, Mike Lewis, and Hannah Brooks Olson. Let's get into our underreported stories for the week now. Hannah, let's start with you.
I don't know that anybody else feels that this is underreported, but I really think the impending budget shutdown is actually not really getting talked about as much as it should. You know, there was all these rumors that the budget would get shored up before Chambers Bay happened because it was going to be hard to do the special session when all the hotel rooms were taken up. But also it was going to be kind of embarrassing if the state was like bordering on a shutdown and we were having this giant Gulf thing. And then that didn't happen. And Chambers Bay came and went. And we still don't have a budget. I feel like it's just very concerning that people don't seem very worried about it. And City Council Member John Okamoto sort of released this statement, like the first real statement he's made, because he's been sort of quiet, you know, he's interim. And he released a statement where he really sort of broke down all of what it meant to have even a partial government shutdown. And it's real consequences, and it's consequences that hit the lowest income and the most in need people. It hits kids, the elderly, people living in poverty. And I just feel like I have a sense of panic about it, and I'm surprised that other people are not similarly
panicking. Part of that comes from the fact that we love to wait till the last minute here.
Oh, gosh. And especially in Olympia.
All right. Thanks for that underreported story. Let's hear your underreported story from Mike Lewis.
You know, my underreported story, I know this is going to sound a little bit counterintuitive to refer to anything with Big Bertha and the tunnel as underreported, but the Seattle Times, I think it was Mike Lindblom, did a terrific story on the defunding of the oversight panel, potentially the costliest public works transportation project in state history. It probably will be. It could be one of the costliest in the country. And the state has essentially said, the state lawmakers, in particular, there's an interesting quote from Judy Cliburn from Mercer Island, who said, you know, what you know might hurt you. sort of an NSA defense on why we shouldn't actually know what's going on probably the most important public works project in the state right now, because it may open us up to liability. I mean, something about all of that, I think, is pretty interesting. And given the lack of coverage on the real specifics of some of this stuff, and given that this panel is made up of engineers, I'm flabbergasted that opening us up to reality is opening us up to liability.
Mike Lewis, thanks for that underreported story. And Sarah Studeville, what's your underreported story of the week?
So for me this week, it was actually this report that came out from the New America Foundation, which is a liberal think tank that, and these are quotes I'm using here, self-proclaimed jihadists are not actually the top perpetrators of terror attacks in the U.S. since 9/11. In fact, they're homegrown extremists. And I thought, of course, that was very interesting in the wake of the South Carolina shooting, and really counter to what, frankly, I thought was the case, and I would guess many other Americans did as well. So that was a big underreported story for me. I think it has a lot of relevance here in Seattle, the Pacific Northwest, Washington State, because we have a big and growing Muslim population, and also because we've had such a recent spate of hate crimes against that population. Yeah, I felt like that deserved a little more play, especially since it speaks to media really miscovering this in a pretty significant way.
Which has been a hot topic lately, no doubt about it. Well, thanks for those underreported stories. I'd like to thank our guests this week, Hannah Brooks Olson from Seattle-ish, Mike Lewis, who is acting online managing editor here at KPLU, and Sarah Studeville, who is co-founder of Seattle Globalist. Thank you all so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks. It was great.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Kevin Kniestead, in for Gabriel Spitzer. Today, we are taking a look at the point of no return. For some people, things are so bad in their home country that they have to get out, leaving everything behind. Bhuta Singh is from India, lives in Kent, Washington, and he has been awaiting asylum for almost 2 years. Mr. Singh is a practicing Sikh, a religious group that has faced persecution by the largely Hindu opposition. Sikhs are not allowed to vote or buy land outside of the Indian state of Punjab, and while accounts in the media vary on what leads to violence between Sikhs and the opposition, Mr. Singh says that Sikh attempts to form their own religion party can result in death.
I'm sure if I'm not come here, if I'm in my country, in India, in Punjab, surely they're going to kill us, sir.
Did you leave any family over there?
My mother is already passed away. I have my mentally handicapped brother, and my father is in India also. Yeah.
So how did you get here?
3 or 4 times they beat me, and beat me badly, you know. And my family think I'm not safe in India. And my father talked with one guy. He said, I need some money. And my father gave him some money and they sent me here.
So your father paid someone to take you out?
Yeah, yeah. In a plane from New Delhi to Suriname. They keep us in a room, in a small room. One time or two times they give us some food or something. I spent 1 month in Suriname. And after that, I'm flied to Nicaragua.
And then what was after Nicaragua?
After that, it's too hard journey start. You know, sometimes in truck, under the seat, you know, the passenger seat. I think 24 hours, three person under the seat is too difficult, too much hot in Nicaragua in June, you know. After that, I don't know which country, Honduras or something. So sometimes they give us food and sometimes or 2 or 3 days we don't eat nothing, no drink, water. After that, Mexico is too much hard journey also. 16 June, I arrived at a Mexican border. I don't know it's Mexican border, but the guy who brought us, he said, you want to go to United States? We said, yes, man. And he said, when the immigration ask you, hey, who are you? And you said, don't tell nothing. Just said, we are American residents. And I saw this United States immigration and Homeland Security. I told the truth. We are from India. We are from Punjab, Punjabi, Sikh. And we need your help. We need your protection. And they said, okay, don't worry. And I'm crying that time. My tears not stop that time. And he said, don't worry. You are here. Your life is safe now. If you want something, you know, you et cetera, et cetera. And they put us in a detention after that.
They put you in detention?
Yeah. And asylum officer took our asylum interview. And we passed that interview. And after that, I tried for my parole. When I passed my credible fear.
Describe what does credible fear mean?
Credible fear means if you are not safe in your country, you stay here. So I tried for my parole several times. You know, they said no. You we don't give you parole. My family hired my now lawyer and they changed my venue to Alpam, Texas to. Seattle, Tacoma, Washington, and after that I got bond over there when I moved in Tacoma.
So you spent 10 months in a detention center in Texas.
Sir.
How did you get out of that prison?
So after that, the immigration didn't give us parole, so we go to hunger strike, and 10 days we eat nothing.
You did a 10-day hunger strike, even though,
yeah.
So you were eligible for parole, but they didn't grant parole to anybody, so you started a hunger strike.
They didn't grant parole, they didn't change our venue. We said, my family is Seattle, we said, if you don't give us parole, please move us. After that, my lawyer got my change of the venue.
So you got moved up to Washington,
to
a detention center in Tacoma?
Yeah, detention in Tacoma. And I spent 1 month in Tacoma Detention Center. And 28 May 2014, I got a bond over there, $7,000 bond. Now still I'm waiting for my asylum, my permanent asylum, my permanent residence card.
So how long do you think it's going to take before you get a permanent residence card? Do you have any idea?
No, I don't have idea right now.
So what are you doing now?
I got a work permit now, and I apply my work permit and work at a Chevron station in Kent, yeah.
Will you ever go back to India?
No.
What about your family?
My father is over there because of my brother. He don't know how to eat, he don't know how to go toilet, he don't know nothing, sir. So that's the problem.
Do you think you'll be able to see them again?
My father?
Your father and your brother.
If I go back to India, they gonna kill me. I'm sure that thing. Yeah.
Pooja Singh is from India and has been awaiting asylum in the United States for 2 years. Mr. Singh, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
And please take care of yourself. And I wish you the best and good luck. And I wish the best for your family as well.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Kevin Kniestad, in for Gabriel Spitzer this week. And we're hearing stories of passing the point of no return. And what if your entire life was shaped by a medical diagnosis? That's what happened to Tracy Coisier. Sound Effect host Gabriel Spitzer spoke with her about how her medical condition played a role in the decisions in her life.
So let's start at the beginning of your journey toward the point of no return, which I gather starts when you were pretty young, right?
I was 5, and we were living in Taiwan at the time, and I started having seizures. And then when we moved back to the States, I was about 9, and we went back to the States, and then we did see a doctor who informed my mother that because the seizures were uncontrollable, I would not be able to drive. Because I would not be able to drive to a job, I would not be employable. So I would have no income of my own so that I would live with them and basically until they died. And that also, oh, by the way, she won't be able to have children.
So you just heard that you were going to never work, live with your parents until they were dead and never have kids.
This is correct.
And what were you thinking? Do you remember?
You know, you're at that age where you realize that your mother's a little nutty. And so all I remember thinking was, I have to live with her for the rest of my life? And so I think that kind of overshadowed the you're barren thing a little bit.
How did that affect the way you thought about yourself, the idea that you would never be a mother?
I don't think that I bought into the romance idea very much, because the whole story is that boy meets girl, they live happily ever after, and they have a picket fence and 2.4 children. And so I think I felt, since I was not going to have that, then I wasn't necessarily going to have, like, why look for your prince?
So how did that affect, like, your dating life?
So at some point when I was in college, I was told that with my anticonvulsants, birth control pills don't always work. And it's not that you can't have kids. You're fine to have children. But if I were you, I would definitely double up.
You can have kids, but you shouldn't.
Anticonvulsants can cause a lot of birth defects, including the brainless baby problem. So I had sponges and condoms and birth control pills. So instead of doubling up, I did triple up.
So how did that kind of go? Did you find a mate?
So I did. I got set up on a date with this guy who on paper was fantastic. He went to Harvard. He clerked for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And then in reality, he was a really weird guy. Like, he didn't use utensils to eat his food. He used his fingers. And so he'd eat and scoop his food up with his hands, and then he would talk and gesticulate, and then he would fling food on you.
Wow. And you were contemplating marrying into this, attaching yourself to this for life.
Yeah. This is my glass slipper, man. You know, he's a little weird, but he would love me in spite of my barrenness. And that was part of his proposal. And so in the middle of this summer with the food flinging politician, I started to not feel well. I was throwing up frequently. I had headaches. I was really dizzy. I had some blurred vision. And so we did every test known to God, except, of course, the one that you would imagine, which is that I was, despite 3 forms of birth control, I was actually pregnant.
So what did you think when you learned that you were pregnant?
By that point, I was really angry. Like, that just can't be possible.
You can choose to get into details or not, but how did that wind up?
So the pregnancy was not long-lived. What they don't tell you is it doesn't really matter how long it is in there or how it comes out. What they don't tell you is that postpartum is horrible. I went into a really, really, really deep depression. I mean, I don't even know at the time if I was like, oh, I'm depressed because I could have had a kid and then I don't have a kid and then we broke up. I don't even know if it was that, but it was just this horrible, I am stuck at the bottom of black inky well and there's no way that I am crawling my way out of it.
So this gets us into your early 30s by now, right?
Yes. Yes, and I'm on this weird quest because I really want my tubes tied. So I finally found a guy in Connecticut. He's like, yep, absolutely. And there were three choices. You could tie the tubes into a little bow and then they could be untied. You could put a clip, like a little springy hair clip on them. And then you could then take the clip off and probably still get pregnant. And then the third and final choice was you would cauterize them. So he would actually just burn them so they'd be severed entirely. And they're so small that it pretty much destroys the fallopian tubes entirety. And so I opted for that final choice.
The irreversible choice.
The completely irreversible choice. And within a week of the surgery, my health really deteriorated really, really quickly. I had one swollen left foot. I had swollen hands. I had giant purple pimples everywhere, rashes. I was a mess. So I ended up going to this doctor. He was so funny. I said, you know, I've had this problem for years in my belly and then this and the hands and the swelling. And he wrote it down on a post-it note. And he goes, I know the answer. I'm so excited to know the answer. So he said, you have celiac disease. And I was like, what? And he's like, listen, just don't eat wheat, barley, oats, or rye anymore. And you're going to feel fantastic. 4 months after having my tubes cauterized, I then realized that my epilepsy, finger quotes around that word, was actually an allergic reaction to wheat.
And you could treat that wheat allergy.
Yeah, just don't eat wheat.
So how did that get you to your next chapter?
September 11th happened. And so then you kind of get to this point where you're like, oh my God, life is really short. That was a real turning point for me. And so I bought this meditation cassette and I closed my eyes. And on the inhale, I had a vision of the Space Needle in my head. And then on the exhale, I felt like I was riding down the elevator. I went to a church a couple of times to see if the praying would work for me, trying to talk to God. I'm having the Space Needle in my head. And so I came to this decision that I was just going to drive to Seattle. Had one person that I knew from high school and one person that I knew from a sorority connection. And the sorority connection person signed me up for a singles party. And the event was at the Space Needle. And I met this guy, James, who seemed kind of boring. I actually say to him on our first date, I have about 75 minutes. Let's just get this over with. Thankfully, he's a forgiving man. The coffee turned into dinner. And then there was this amazing kiss. And he said, I really want to see you again. And we married 1 year later. And then 5 years after that, I gave birth to twin girls.
You didn't have any problem getting pregnant or carrying your kids to term, even though your tubes were gone.
Well, I knew. And when the guy took my tubes out all those years ago, he said, listen to me. If you change your mind, do in vitro, go straight to Petri dish.
Ah, hot dog. So the point of no return, you returned from it.
I did.
So what do you make of this now, looking back on it, besides just having your head spin?
I love motherhood so much. Every day, even if they're screaming and crying, I was like, this is amazing. Because I never thought I was going to get this. And one day, one of my girls, Charlotte, somehow she took my favorite cookbook ever. And then it caught on fire a little bit because she put it too close to a candle. And I think it happened on Mother's Day weekend. And so I wrote a note to myself that said, just think how fantastic it is that you have a daughter that can set your cookbook on fire.
That was Tracy Coisier speaking with Gabriel Spitzer. We first learned about Tracy and her story at the storytelling event, A Guide to Visitors. You can find more information about A Guide to Visitors at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Kevin Kniestead, in for Gabriel Spitzer this week, and we're examining all different points of no return on the show. And for our last story, I'm joined by Sound Effect senior producer Arwin Nix. Hello, Arwin.
Hi, Kevin.
So this next story is about many points of no return.
So many points of no return. The story starts in 2005 when Amelia Bono and Brian Yeager first meet. They were both working just down the street from where we are now in Belltown.
I remember the first time I saw him walk by. He's just a person that you see and you don't forget.
I was bartending at the Lava Lounge. and she was a waitress or a hostess at Mama's. And she used to stalk me.
He's a tall, skinny Jew from Texas with huge brown eyes and the darkest brown eyelashes.
I had a girlfriend. I was completely unaware of her. She would, like, watch me walk up and down the street and kind of was crushing on me from afar.
Eventually, I started going into the Lava Lounge.
She was just young and beautiful and a little crazy. I could tell by the way she was looking at me. She wanted to kiss.
I knew I was in love with Brian after speaking to him 3 times.
One day, I guess she kind of seduced me one day at the Lava Lounge. We ended up staying after.
At the end of the 3rd conversation, he just sort of looked at me and he said, "Why don't you walk down to the end of the bar?" I walked down to the end of the bar and he looked at me and he said, "I want you to kiss me really softly on the lips." And I did.
Emily and I kind of had like the typical, you know, really sexy, heavy few days.
I was the kind of electrified in a way that I think only happens a couple of times in a life. I mean, it was just something I was certain of then and I'm certain of now.
Just something's really happening here. You know what I mean? It was just that kind of, you could feel it. The energy was there, you know? But we didn't plan on being together 6 years, but.
It was absolutely necessary that I make this person realize that we are in love.
It just happened. You know what I mean? Like we knew we were going to fall madly in love with each other. Everything was perfect.
He looked at me and he was like, "All right, I'm going to break up with my girlfriend tonight." And then he said, "Do you steal things?" And I was like, "No." And he walked me into this back closet of the back bedroom, which 4 years later became our bedroom. And he opened up a locked box that was sitting on the floor of the closet. And he took out a copy of The Catcher in the Rye. That was a first edition copy. And he said, "I want you to know that I play music and I always will. And I'm never going to make any money. And when it comes down to it, I'll sell this book, and that's my plan, that's how I'm gonna make it work, but I'm not ever gonna be like a normal guy." And I was like, "All right."
It was never dull. I mean, we were always talking, constantly challenging each other, talking about everything. I loved her brain so much, and I loved just being with her and having her around me and living together and all that. Loved it a lot.
We just instantly started to belong to each other.
She was my best friend, like my absolute best friend.
Describe the house for me physically. What did it look like?
500 West Republican was like probably the most special house in all of Queen Anne.
That house was a total anomaly.
Anybody that saw it, like if you walked in and you saw it, everybody had the same reaction. It was just a magical little spot.
It faced into this forest that was like above Elliott Street.
You can't even see the house from the road. It was right where Republican dead end.
It had a huge deck that wrapped around the back half and was supported by stilts.
With an almost completely unobstructed panoramic view. Beautiful light.
However, I will take credit that I deserve for always feeling a sense of doom about that house.
You would have felt it. Like nobody walked in that house and didn't feel it.
And it wasn't even creepy. It was just like a dark power that this house had.
Did you ever see Evil Dead? You know, it kind of looked like that.
And it was so isolated. Like we could sit in the yard, in the front yard in our underwear, and we could bash the drum kit at 4 a.m. and nobody even knew we were there. Like the UPS guy couldn't find it.
I loved it. I could live in that. I like that kind of energy and magic. You know what I mean? And it's like, if it did spook me, I just wouldn't believe in it. She didn't want to move into it. She was terrified of it.
It was cheap and it was gorgeous. And there was no reason for me to not move in there, but I didn't want to.
It's just funny that we waited so long because I loved living with her so much. And she brought so much life to that house. It was unbelievable. I mean, she painted the walls, which I was like, I never even considered.
I got rid of all of the bad art. I filled it with plants. It worked. Like, we were able to reinvent the emotional blueprint of the house.
Like it kind of took the evil out a little bit, like this, the eeriness out of it a little bit. It was still kind of an eerie place because it was just so old.
It still never felt safe to me.
So why did you two break up?
Why did we break up? Oh, that question.
Why did we break up?
At some point about, like shortly after I moved into the house, he joined this band that just was going to tour all the time, and that is what he's always wanted.
I know 4 or 5 months, it's not that much, but when you spread it out over a year, it was hard for me to be home.
There's no part of me that ever wants to make the person I love feel kept, even if in some ways that means that they are moving away from me, I guess.
I think we just wanted to sleep with other people. I mean, that was just bottom line. Like, we wanted to kiss other people, and it was really confusing and really difficult because I loved her so much.
I just sort of woke up one day and realized that I felt like an independent operator, and I didn't feel like Brian was my person anymore. I felt like I was my person.
It wasn't like you're out of my life or I can't talk to you for a while, or it wasn't like that at all. Like there wasn't even that desire, you know? It was just I need to go do other things for a while.
You know, I had fallen in love with him when I was 20 years old, and I needed to be with other people. I needed to have different experiences. I needed to live in a studio apartment with all my own things and have sex with boys and girls and do whatever I wanted and not grow up yet.
I was gonna go on tour, and then when I got back, she was gonna be gone.
I remember just like laying in bed, barely speaking to each other for like 3 days before he left. And then I remember getting out of bed and looking at, like, you know, the garden we had planted, and we were holding hands, and he was just like, "Amelia, what are we gonna do with this beautiful house?" And I was like, "We'll figure that out when you're on tour."
I'm leaving, and she's just sobbing. I mean, just sobbing.
I was like stunned at myself that I had actually made this decision, and I just laid in our bed and just soaked it with my tears.
We're just kissing her and kissing her and kissing her, and she's crying so hard. I mean, I can just, it's like her face is soaking wet. I can taste the tears on her lips, you know? Like, she's just, her eyes are closed and she's sobbing, and I'm, you know, it's just like kissing, and I have to go. I mean, my band's outside waiting for me.
He just came over to me and he kissed me, and he said, "I love you, Amelia. I'll see you on the other side of this." And I mean, I really think we both thought that that's what was going to happen.
Got in the van, and it was this, I just had the heaviest feeling inside of my body.
And then he left, and then he was gone. And then I was in this house by myself.
It felt so hard to leave, you know? I guess I wish I didn't. But you, what do? You have to go, you know?
The house had become a place that I just did not want to be. I called my best friend at the time, and I just told her, "Things have gotten so bad that I don't feel like I can keep myself safe. I can't be here, and I don't have anywhere to go. Will you please come pick me up?" And then Brian called me. He was just coming unglued on the phone, screaming sadness at me. And I just said, "I'm sorry, I can't talk to you right now. I'm trying to get out of this house. I'm getting out tonight. I have to. And I'll talk to you in a couple of days." And then I got off the phone, and my friend and I went outside and smoked a cigarette on the back porch. We put our cigarettes out in an ashtray that was sitting on the arm of a chair. And then we walked back inside, and I looked at her and I said, "All right, just help me get out of here without burning this house down." We went over to Rooster, who was sitting on the couch. I sat next to her and I was petting her, and I was like, "Okay, Rooster, I'm really sorry to do this to you, but I gotta get out of here. I can't be here anymore. It's not healthy for me. I'm sorry that I'm leaving. I'm sorry that Brian's always leaving. I'm sorry that this place feels like hell, but I just have to go, and I love you." and then we just walked out the front door. And my best friend looked at me and said, "It's weird that you just said that thing about fire, because it totally smells like fire out here." And I was like, "Huh." And then we just left.
When, you know, when your somebody calls you early in the morning like that, you know something's up.
I looked at my phone at 7 a.m. and there were 6 missed calls from Brian's twin brother, Nathan. And I just immediately knew that the house had burned down.
I just said, "Brian?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Everything's gone." And he said, "Everything's gone. Your house burned down."
And I called him, and all I heard were just sirens and screams, and he was just screaming, "You're alive, you're alive. You have to come here, everything's gone."
Did you know that Amelia was okay?
Oh yeah, he didn't call me before. He knew she was okay, because he thought she was dead. And, you know, my cat too, he was trying to find Rooster, so.
I mean, I got there, and they were like, I immediately was approached by the arson investigator.
They can't find Rooster.
And they had pen drawing of the house.
And I remember just kind of putting my hand on my abdomen and saying her name.
They were like, "We need to talk to you about some stuff." And I was like, "Am I going to go to jail if I did this?" And they were like, "No." I was like, "All right, why don't you show us on this drawing exactly where you smoked and where you put the cigarette out?"
Her too, you know what I mean? Kind of like, really? Everything and her.
It was just like this long, slow burn that lasted all night, and then it was finally just like consumed in a blaze.
What a way to go.
All my dresses, all my grandmother's dresses, every photograph I've ever taken, every love letter, all of the evidence that I had ever existed.
None of it meant anything to me, like the possessions and the stuff. Like, I didn't care about it, it was gone. As hard as that was, there was also something kind of like liberating about it. I had a firebox in the back bedroom and I asked her to get that. I think that's when she really started crying. And then they came out with it. Whatever, I don't know, it seemed like a minute later, but it was probably 15 minutes later because we were talking. And then she just started sobbing, and all she kept saying was, "They have it, they have it."
There was his locked box that had the Catcher in the Rye in it.
And there was a lot of joy and elation in her, you know what I mean? Like, she felt like, we got something out of the fire, you know what I mean? Like, something came out. Like.
So when you come back, you end up getting some money from the insurance that you have.
70K.
So what did you do?
I traveled. I took off. At first, I begged Amelia to come with me.
I was like, "We can't get back together. We're not supposed to. Not right now. Maybe not ever. And I think it's going to be really hard not to just fall into each other's arms, because we love each other and we've just gone through something that is so unique and so isolating that how are we supposed to not lean on each other right now, you know?"
And she decided she didn't want to do that. She wanted her, she had her own path, her own road to go down. And so I went to Asia.
I just drove around with a rotating cast of characters to different places, collecting things that people were giving me.
Nobody there knew my house burned down. Nobody there knew I had just broken up with in a 6-year relationship. Nobody knew me. And that's why I had to leave. I mean, everybody here that I knew.
Bands were playing shows, and everywhere I'd ever worked was doing a clothing drive.
So I had to leave. I wanted to leave and go somewhere and just breathe and walk. Be really, really slow. Be very intentional.
And then it was I need garbage cans. We'll keep this box. I need a shower curtain.
I didn't need a couch. I needed time. You know, I didn't need a new house. I needed time.
Simultaneously, along with this just crushing, interrelated, like, huge dark cloud of bad feelings. I was just being, like, lifted through it by humanity in this way that, like, it was completely transformative. It made me feel, like, connected to other people in a way that I totally took with me, you know? And it made me feel so lucky.
I remember being in Burma, and I'd wake up, and I'd just sit on this, like, log on the Bay of Bengal, looking at this green, beautiful green ocean, alone, and just crying, and thinking about her, and wanting her to be there so bad with me. I didn't understand why I was there alone.
How is your relationship to physical possessions different now?
I have ghost things that I, like, sometimes, like, even today, I'll be like, oh, I want to hear this record. And I'll go over and start looking for it. I'm like, oh yeah, old record collection.
I mean, I think that it really just made me certain of just the ephemeral nature of all things, whether it's a love affair that you think is going to last your whole life or an article of clothing or whatever. I mean, I'm not trying to say that it made me totally not materialistic, but I haven't lost anything since then that I've thought about the next day.
I'm just now, in the last, like, 3 months, getting to where I'm settling into a home.
Just in the last 3 months?
Yep. That's how long it's taken me. Like, I really, for a long time, just was like, I don't need anything, and I can live like this forever. And then when I did, like, get an apartment, I bought one bowl, you know? Two coffee cups, one coffee maker. Now I have a coffee cup collection, you know, and a lot of forks.
Is there anything that you're glad burned?
I mean, kind of everything.
Yeah, all of it.
Because my life couldn't ever look the way it does without all of that getting erased, and I really like my life.
I don't have to ever move it again. I don't have to ever pack it. I don't ever have to worry about it.
And I really like the person that I am because this happened to me.
So you and Amelia are still really close.
Yeah.
I mean, we're like best friends.
To me, it was, I had to bring her closer and closer to me because it was, what a horrible thing to feel, you know? How gnarly is that?
It's like, if you can get through that with somebody, it's just not on the table that we would ever not be close.
Because we know each other so well. I mean, so intimately, you know? Like, when you spend 6 years with somebody like that, like, you build something pretty special. Or we did, at least.
You know, I think that it would be really easy to have something like this happen and live scared because of it, you know? But I think that the opposite thing happened to both of us, and that's really beautiful.
All right, that's all I got.
Cool.
The senior producer of Sound Effect is Arwen Nix, who I have to thank every time I host the show for her rare ability to share an office with me each and every single day. Arwen, if you go home at the end of the day and have a good scream, it's totally justified. We have production help from Matthew Stribe, our intern is Brianna Ripley, and we have web help from Mike Lewis. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy, and thanks this week to Liberty Bar on Capitol Hill. You can find our show on iTunes. While you're there, write us a review. You can also drop us a note at soundeffect@kplu.org. Our host, Gabriel Spitzer, did not reach the point of no return, at least not with this show, and we'll be back behind the mic next week when we talk about growing pains.
How do you tell someone you want to have sex with them without coming off like a creeper?
I'm Kevin Kniestead, and you're listening to 88.5 KPLU.